Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Quentin Hardy, head of editorial at Google Cloud, and the moderator for tonight's program. Our speaker tonight is John Yoo, who is here to discuss his new book, Striking Power: How Cyber, Robots, and Space Weapons Change the Rules for War. John has been a professor at Berkeley Law since 1993. In addition to this, he served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General under the George W. Bush administration, clerked for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, and worked on complex issues of national security. John, thanks for joining us. This is a very intriguing book to me because on one level it is about these new technologies of war, and on a deeper level, I think it's about the whole nature of warfare, nations at war, and the rule of law, the law of war. I think that's a strange idea for some people. So why don't we just set that ground to begin with and talk about the laws of war.
Thanks, Quentin. Thank you also to the Commonwealth Club for having us be the inaugural program of this new beautiful building. I mean, this is an incredible building, and you're very lucky to have it, and I feel very fortunate that we're here today. I will warn you, I've had a long day. I gave a speech at Berkeley. This never happened to me, and someone had a stroke in the audience during my speech. I'm sure that's not going to happen
tonight.
Something
you said?
But I'm going to be less provocative than usual.
Darn. We'll see about that.
So, it's interesting. As Quentin said, the book is about technology, but it's also got a deeper message about the laws of war, how nations fight, how they agree on rules in the first place. And we have a long-running discussion about what is international law, do nations follow it? But to the extent they do, it seems they follow it primarily when it comes to how they fight wars, where you are quite right, you would think that this would be the area where they would follow law the least. Cicero has a famous comment that when wars start, the laws end. But actually, we argue that's not been the case. There's been a lot of principles throughout human history that have come forward in war and have limited how harsh and difficult war can be.
In an extreme way, there's sort of like statements about what we are not. We would not be the people who would do this. We've stepped over that boundary and found something horrible. The great example would be the use of gas in World War I, which almost to a vanishing point didn't really be used in the war of World War II. Instead, it was used on the people in the concentration camps. But there, for the people contesting the battle, that just vanished. But then other more problematic technologies came about. But you seem to see the idea of the law of war under a peculiar kind of tension now. And we'll get to the technologies in a minute, but you also have an argument with things that happened in the 1970s around constraints placed on some nations.
Yeah, so part of the story of the book is that the laws of war, like law domestically, is the product of ideological combat. That there are countries, like there are groups in our own society, that want to change the law to advance their own interests. And what we saw after World War II was we saw the great decolonization of the world. And so many more nations came to exist, and they sought to rewrite the rules of war to remove the advantages that the Western countries had had, which were primarily technological in nature. And so one of the big changes occurred in 1977. There's a new Geneva Convention that was written called the Additional Protocol to the Geneva Convention that sought to give terrorists and freedom fighters the same protections as Western fighters. And for that reason, the United States actually refused to sign that treaty. We still are not a party to it. But that's an example of the kind of changes that were going on, and they were ideological in nature to try to use law to, you know, rewrite the balance of power.
Now, these non-state actors were to be given the same status as nations. Were they, on a reciprocal level, expected to obey the rules of war?
That was the difficult thing, I think, for the treaty writers, and we've had ever since. And you can see it in the war on terror we have now. You can see it in the war between the British and the Irish and the IRA, or you can see it in the wars involving Israel and Palestinians and Arab countries now, is even though you're going to have different capabilities, different types of fighting, is everything supposed to be reciprocal? Do we require those who fight against us to follow the same rules? And our argument in the book is that I think actually the people who wrote the New Geneva Conventions tried to actually give the benefit of the doubt to the freedom fighter or the liberation, the non-state actors, to give them a kind of advantage in war, that we would not require them to follow the exact same rules that we did. And then the point of the book, the reason we're talking about in the book, is that technology places even more pressure
right
on that difference.
Let's talk about some of those new technologies. You cite three in particular. So run them down in order of importance, if you will.
Yes, our main argument is that the changes in technology that we're seeing all around us in the economy, in daily life, robotics, as we're seeing the emergence of self-driving cars, obviously the internet, information revolution, broad use of information and analysis, and then space. One thing that is going on, you see it in SpaceX, for example, is the cost of launching satellites has fallen by 90% in the last decade. The cost of space has really fallen. Just as those are causing lots of changes in our economy and society, which I think you at Google know. Actually, I wish I knew as much as you did at Google about what's really going on. But these are all going to affect our militaries and our warfare too. But with a big difference in that our argument is that in the past, when new technology has come to war, it's had the effect of making war more destructive, more harmful, and less discriminate in the sense that civilians are the ones who are really suffering in war in the 20th century. New technologies, as far as we can tell, are going to have, in a way that they are also having the civilian economy, less harmful, more precise, less destructive, which has not happened really in human history before.
Mm-hmm. But so space war and war by robot, or as we see them now, drones, and cyber war are sort of three aspects of warfare that you seem to think can be utilized or controlled largely by large nation state actors to kind of restore a system of order in the world that's fragmenting right now under this turmoil of non-state actors that's been underway, since well before the 70s, really. How would that take place? How can they control this?
So our concern is that there are nations and governments, and the United Nations, for example, and NGOs that are pressing for a ban on a lot of these technologies. You might have seen just 2 weeks ago Elon Musk and 100 tech CEOs called for a ban on the development of AI and robotics and warfare. The main argument is that this is going to spread war too much. It's going to be too easy and cheap. Our argument in response is that the big problem actually that we're seeing now, and I think we're really seeing it come to a crucible in places like Iran and North Korea now, is you're seeing, I think the threat of disorder is greater than the worry that countries are going to go to war too easily. And so you're going to see things more like Syria happen, I'm afraid, where the nations of the world take a hands-off attitude at first and let these crises get worse, or Rwanda's, where a very small detachment of Western troops could have stopped the killing of 900,000 people. So our argument is that if there is a barrier or reluctance to nations like the United States and other nations from stepping up and trying to prevent things like the Syrian civil war, prevent things like Rwanda from happening, maybe these kind of technologies will make it easier to stop those kinds of, right, as you said, the rise in disorder in the world.
Let's spend a minute on drones, because that seems to be sort of the one people identify most with, mm-hmm. an extension of conventional war. Mm-hmm. What is it about drones people find objectionable, and how do you speak to that?
So the arguments are, there are two kinds of arguments. One, I think, is a legitimate argument, and one, I think, is a little bit science fiction-y, if that's a, I don't know if that's a word. I think the legitimate argument is drones make it cheap and easy to use force. We don't have any of our own soldiers at risk. We saw this particularly in the Obama administration. You can be so precise in the way you use drones. You don't really worry about collateral damage the way we used to, because you can hit one building or even hit one person, and you don't kill a lot of civilians nearby. You don't destroy lots of buildings. So the argument is, it's just easy to press the button to use the drone all the time, rather than turning to diplomacy or sanctions or something first. The broader argument that is made by people like Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking or Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple, is that this is putting us on the road to losing our control and independence as human beings.
Skynet.
Yeah, that the robots are going to take over. Mm-hmm. And they said these in these letters, that once we launch these weapons, once we launch artificial intelligence, we're no longer going to be able to control it. They're going to eventually take over our defense systems, and they're going to start making decisions, not human beings. That, I think, is way far off, and I've not seen any proof that that would actually happen. But the argument that war becomes cheap and easy is,
no.
That's undeniable. I think we saw that for the last 10, 15 years, actually.
There's also the peculiar argument that, there is a valid argument that the collateral damage is understated, and in fact, frequently, many people are killed because the targeting changes. You don't meet on the field of war, you target them at home. But that's part of the larger problem for many people, which is, this is a form of assassination. This is not a form of war. Mm-hmm. Is that a legitimate objection? And how does war differ from assassination anyway? Wasn't World War II a large effort to kill one man in Berlin?
Yeah, no, the curious thing about the assassination argument is that if it were correct, then would force you instead to use much more destructive weapons to try to achieve the same goal. So if it is legitimate to try to target Osama bin Laden, and you're using drones or other high-tech weapons to do it, why is it more immoral or more illegal to use a drone to launch a missile to try to hit that one, rather than what we would have done in pre-drone days, which is launched a bombing run with manned bombers and destroyed a lot more buildings.
Carpet bomb.
So it's actually the precision of it that makes people recoil at some level, but it's the precision that actually is making casualties in war drop.
This is one of the interesting aspects of warfare in the last 50 or 60 years, really. World War II was sort of the greatest and most tragic expression of Napoleonic-style war, big armies facing each other off, with, as you note, this acceleration in the number killed. And it just stopped working around the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And we've been in a 64-year truce with the North Koreans. Mm-hmm. We haven't ever ended that war. Mm-hmm. And we don't fight to take territory as much as sort of own an argument or control economic assets. It's a new form of coercion that's taking mm-hmm. place. And a strange but quite hopeful development, actually, is we value individual lives so much more than we used to as well, except at least the visible ones. Mm-hmm. The invisible ones seem to go in huge numbers. But if you look at in Vietnam, we lost 220 Americans a week. Can you imagine that taking place now? At least on the U.S. side, there's so little appetite for a loss of life. Well, probably taking fewer lives on the other side, but the numbers get very squishy. And this feathers into another element of this that you talk about, which are the three other types of new technology that are in state and non-state actors' hands, which are biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, which you also see affecting war.
Well, let me say, I hadn't thought of it quite the way you just put it, but I agree with that. It's an interesting way to look at it, which is In a way, we're not fighting wars like World War I, World War II, Napoleonic Wars to just completely win anymore. We're trying to manage problems in the world.
It underlines the media power that every soldier who falls has a backstory now. Can you imagine that at Normandy?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so this is how the technologies, I think, then how I would say they interact with your point, which is that if we're in a world, take North Korea, we're stuck between essentially trying to bribe him, the North Korean regime, or think about launching a war. The President Trump was just tweeting, Rex Tillerson, why are you wasting your time on negotiations? After he sent them there for negotiations. So it's an interesting bargain.
Well, that was
strategy. Interesting. Yeah. It's like they're playing bad cop and bad cop.
Rex Tillerson, why didn't you tell me you were negotiating with North Korea is the other premise of that, which is an interesting thought.
But I think, in our policy, it's a bipartisan problem, right? Presidents since the first Clinton term have not solved this problem. But I think that's because we're stuck between this total war, this old World War II, Korean War view, or nothing. And the hope, I think, is that technologies will provide ways of pressuring other countries that don't force us to have to just go to war.
Right.
All these kinds of things, cyber, robotics, even space weapons, if you have different ways of pressuring other nations, hopefully that's going to head off something like a rush to an absolute war like in North Korea.
And that is the hazard. You seem to indicate, and obviously, the three fearsome technologies, if you will, chemical, nuclear, and biological, are very anarchic forms of violence, mm-hmm. whereas you're positing that the cyber and space and robotic ones are more precise, if mm-hmm. you will. And that's the concern.
Yeah, if you think about nuclear weapons, they are the most indiscriminate form of weapon. They don't discriminate between combatants and civilians. They just destroy whole cities, right? They're a form of the old technology, and the way warfare and weapons had been advancing was in that direction. And then these new weapons really, I think, turn it around in a different direction.
Well,
precision.
That was a question I had reading the book. You said that perhaps these three can be used to coerce mm-hmm. so that people don't use the deadly anarchic ones.
Yeah.
What's the scenario where that happens?
So take North Korea. I think that's the hardest foreign policy problem we have right now. So you could say, look, at one level, when it comes time to defense, high-speed computing, robotics, space platforms could allow us to build a more complete missile defense system that would be more in the region.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about our missile defense system now, it's the most primitive one you could design. It's designed to shoot missiles down as they're in their and it's called a terminal phase for a reason. It's when the missiles have left space and they're rushing to the targets.
Yes, they're doing their ballistic work. They're just falling.
And you really are trying to shoot a bullet with a bullet. It's incredible that we can even make contact. Where you want to have missile defense work is when the missiles are in their what's called their boost phase, when they're first taking off. That's mm-hmm. the easiest time to strike them. If you could use drones and space and sea-based weapons, we've got the fleet in this week. These ships could deploy these kinds of systems and station a missile defense around North Korea just to shoot down the missiles, not invade North Korea, not bomb anyone in North Korea, but shoot down missiles at the easiest time to shoot them down. That's the way new technology can contribute to some kind of intermediate step between nothing and full war.
Mm-hmm.
And then another thing, Google or cyber, from your Google experience, there's cyber weapons. North Korea is one of the most isolated regimes in the world. But we just saw a story today. They're still trying to sell things. They're still trying to buy and sell in the international economy. And so why couldn't we use cyber to freeze all assets of any company doing business with North Korea, freeze all the money of all the regime members, just make life difficult? And that's what we're trying to get back to, is force was not about waging war and wiping out other countries. It was about trying to pressure them to change their policies in mm-hmm. a graduated way.
This comes to a head. Oh, thank you. This comes to a head in the last page where you say, referring to MacArthur taking the surrender of Japan in 1945. Since 1945, no American war has ended with a formal surrender ceremony, let alone a ceremony on a U.S. warship near the enemy capital. The more pressing question is whether the new weapons can compel rogue actors to stop their worst practices. And this, I think, gets to the crux of things, which is, can the nation states continue to sort order in the world, or are we headed to something more anarchical?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the deeper challenge, and we are, when you see things like Assyria, North Korea, those are all just manifestations of this bigger trend.
Or non-state actors like ISIS or Al-Qaeda or
Al-Qaeda.
Fill out the list.
Yeah, and so my worry is that the kind of order we have enjoyed since the end of World War II that has led to enormous prosperity for us and our allies is slipping away. And if we are going to pursue a more isolationist foreign policy with a desire to pull back our footprint from the world, it's going to get worse. It's going to accelerate. So if there are ways for the United States to still maintain its influence by using technology, even without risking casualties, I think we should all be for it. And it may not work. I mean, I'm more of an optimist. You might be more of a pessimist that this is just going to happen no matter what we do.
I think your final argument is it may not work, but what else have you got?
Yeah, what else can we try?
Yeah. Not to get too pessimistic about that, but part of the hazard is now the technologies and the kind of actors we're dealing with on the international stage have really muddied things to a point where it's hard to parse and discern where a nation state begins and ends and criminal or non-state actors take forth. Russian hackers affecting the U.S. election. Or imagine a ransomware attack from a Chinese military university that injures the financial system. Is that a criminal act? Is that university hacking? Is that the Chinese military by proxy? How do we sort where things begin and end the way we used to?
So I completely agree those are all problems we're confronting right now,
right,
for the last year or two. And we have not figured them out. I think in Washington and our other intellectual leaders are all very confused about how to treat something like a hacking attack from a state-sponsored organization or even just a terrorist group. Is it an act of war? Is it a crime? I think for the last few years, let me back up. In the book, we argue why we've had success in things like weapons of mass destruction technology so far was deterrence. And you see deterrence when offense is cheap and defense is expensive. So nuclear weapons are a great example. It's very easy and cheap to make nuclear weapons, almost impossible to construct a defense. Yet we lived with the Soviet Union for 50 years without having a nuclear exchange because of deterrence. I think that's what the solution is going to be to these vulnerabilities you've just mentioned. The two technologies give us some weapons, but they also make us extremely vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
The only way, I think, to stop it is to construct a system of deterrence, because playing defense is so much more expensive than launching thousands of cyber attacks, which are very cheap and easy.
Another aspect of this would be the nation state becoming much more of an active agent of surveillance on its own population and on populations in movement elsewhere. Mm-hmm. You see that happening?
I mean, that's clearly going on now. It's interesting. I mean, I think the private companies are way ahead of what governments can do. No offense to Google, but I think, Google, I'm sure, can do much more than the United States government can in terms of what knowledge it has. But we want you
we
to.
Sell we sell kayaks.
No, that's what I mean. We give
Come
it.
Come on.
No, we voluntarily give it to you.
We
that's
help other people sell kayaks. We don't even own kayaks. Come on.
No, I agree. This is the amazing thing, is we willingly give it to the corporations, and that's fine. That's
on the enterprise
choice.
Side where I work, we don't keep your data.
Yeah.
Point taken.
So you say.
So it's true. Would you comment on the presumed sonic attack on our embassy in Havana? How does that stand? As an act of belligerence.
That's very interesting. I mean, we're not, as far as I know, we're not really sure what it is. I mean, it's...
Well, we're not talking about what it is, because that's
it sounds
awkward.
Like it is, the Cuban government is harassing our embassy officials. And I think, again, it's a deterrent issue. I think the United States has to do something back. to Cubans, to the Cuban mission in the United States, or the Cuban embassy in the United States, or, you know, expel.
The standard quid pro quo.
Yeah, because that's the point of the book, is that's really what seems to work when nation mm-hmm. states do things like this to each other, is reciprocity.
Yeah, deterrence. Seek a proportionate. And
rather than escalate, like I would, you know, we've normalized relations with Cuba. I think this is not something at the level where we should just cut off diplomatic relations. We've already crossed that line. But it seems to me that if the Cuban government is using sonic weapons against our embassy employees and officials, then we ought to kick out all the members of the Cuban embassy in the United States.
It's a tough proof. That's the problem. And that's frequently a problem with cyber as well. And as far as that's concerned, another question, when or how do you see a Geneva Convention on cyber war coming about?
This is a very interesting question. There are a number of experts who've actually drafted a Geneva Convention on cyber.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gone through, they've created a manual. It's called the Tallinn Manual because it was written in Tallinn, Estonia, by a bunch of experts from all around. Our argument, though, is that that's not going to work because it's too early in the development and use of these weapons. Actually, I think we compare it to World War I. So you might remember World War I was really the first major war that saw the use of mass production economic techniques in wartime. You draft armies, cheap mass-produced weapons. You saw the emergence of submarines, aerial bombing, long-range artillery, tanks eventually. There were all kinds of efforts right away at the beginning to try to pass laws to regulate all these weapons. They all failed because you don't know enough about them in the beginning to tell. So, for example, some countries will believe that they will have an advantage from these weapons. Like I would say China and Russia are rapidly accelerating in these areas because they want to leapfrog us. They think it's a way to neutralize our enormous conventional superiority. They won't sign. If you ever have a situation, you're not going to have any kind of agreement signed.
But there are. Go ahead.
I was just saying there will be a time, like with nuclear weapons, right? There were no nuclear weapons treaties until the 70s, really. Then you saw an agreement to freeze the arsenals and then to reduce them. That's when there was a rough balance of equality between all the players. And right now, no one knows whether that's when that happens. That's when you'll see, I think, a code of conduct that will regulate cyber.
Well, and. Unfortunately, the above ground treaty came about a little bit earlier, and it really had a lot to do with the fact that we had a hydrogen bomb test that was three times larger than we expected and released an enormous amount of radiation. It was a U.S. move that resulted in a U.S.-Russia agreement. Let's hope it isn't some terrible accident like that that causes it. Before that, you could take some steps. As you were saying in your book, there seems to be some agreement that the limitations, deliberate killing of civilians is wrong, though infrastructure and property seem to be okay. A cyber attack, say, that affected vital civilian infrastructure, the water system, or distorted the water system, would be unacceptable. Could you get parties to agree on something like that ahead of time?
Yeah, again, I think it would have to be a mutual threat. So if the United States says, if Russia or China, if you ever open up a dam, shut down the electricity to a whole city, then we will do exactly the same amount right back to you immediately. Then I think you'll get an understanding that will start to take these things off the table.
You have a lot of friends in government. Don't you think that's already taken place?
No, I actually think, if you look, based on just public reports, I think what the Obama administration at the end was hoping, and this is why we didn't retaliate to a lot of these rather open and notorious attacks from China and Russia, is they were hoping by showing restraint that we would be able to create a kind of norm of conduct that would take these weapons off the table. I'm afraid, and it was a chance. You know, they were hoping Russia and China would restrain themselves too. I think instead they took advantage of us.
Mm-hmm.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
How can you even call drone killing warfare? There is no war or battlefield. The U.S. is killing people as they are sleeping, attending wedding parties and funerals, having dinner with their families. This is simple and direct high-tech murder.
That's from Homeland.
Oh, the show Homeland.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
I think the hardest problem that came out of 9/11. It's not really technology-driven, if you think about it. It's what is the nature of a conflict with a non-state actor? And that we are divided as a society about that. We have been ever since 9/11. I'd be the first one to admit that. If you think it is a war, then all of those things you described are legitimate to do in war. It doesn't matter whether it's drones or an artillery strike. If someone is a member of the armed forces of the enemy, you're allowed to attack them, whether they're sleeping or not, right? If it's crime, if we thought 9/11 was a start of just a big criminal conspiracy, well, you can't kill suspects. You have to go out and arrest them. And so it doesn't really have to do with the drones and the technology. It's just the real problem is just the fundamental nature of what is it possible to have a war with a non-state actor?
Yeah.
I would just add that, you know, our presidents of both parties now and the Congress and the courts have all agreed that 9/11 was a start of a war. If it is a start of a war, then those tactics are permissible.
It does get into some very peculiar territory, too, because if you remember the first Gulf War, there was great concern that Iraq might use fuel-air explosives. Mm-hmm. In fact, the U.S. used fuel-air explosives to take out that line of soldiers fleeing Kuwait and just obliterated tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers. Mm-hmm. So that's killing at scale. Mm-hmm. It's a peculiarity of language and diplomacy that you call one killing and one murder in some sense, or do you disagree?
I think murder, probably not in the sense used by the questioner, is, you know, to me, killing that is illegal in the criminal justice system. But killing is legal in warfare. You can use all kinds of weapons to do it. But just because it takes place in war means it's not murder. In the sense, I think
this is a gruesome but true conversation throughout history. This is simply a reality.
I think the problem is again that we are fighting, as you brought up in the beginning, this idea that the warfare is now coming into the hands of non-nation states, and they're going to be able to access a lot of these technologies too and use them. Do we really think that the criminal justice system is capable of handling something like an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda when it's a non-state actor that has a lot of the elements of an organized crime group?
You're likely to create a police system much more like a military, which to some extent has happened since 9/11.
Yeah, I mean, the hope is that if you stop it from coming here, you don't have to engage in a lot of things that our European counterparts do. I mean, if you walk around airports or train stations in Europe, you will see, military troops patrolling, mm-hmm. and they have European governments use far more intrusive surveillance and police powers than we would tolerate here because it's already there. And,
right.
And they have a history of it too from previous terrorist wars. I think so far we haven't had to go as far as Europe, and I hope we don't have to. But you're right. If ISIS and if people worry that if ISIS loses its territory in Iraq and Syria, all those people are going to try to infiltrate into the West, then you're right. Then you're going to have that concern.
Mm-hmm. This is a question a little bit away from the topic of the book, but in the wake of the events in Las Vegas today, I will allow. What are the pros and cons of gun control?
Well, I got to tell you that's not in the book.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mean, I think if it were not for the Second Amendment, we would probably have much broader gun control here than we do already. So, as you know, the Second Amendment to the Constitution says protects the right to bear arms, although it's interesting, the Supreme Court did not identify that as an individual right until about less than 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so until then, no one was sure whether gun control regulations and restrictions, whether they were constitutional. So at the same time, the Supreme Court upheld the individual right to bear arms. It also said that right is subject to reasonable regulation. We don't know what reasonable regulation means yet at the Supreme Court level. They've not taken another case. But, for example, all the lower courts have upheld a ban on, for example, the weapon used, unfortunately, yesterday, an automatic weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So the courts have said if the government wants to, the government's not saying you can't have any guns, but it's saying you can't have fully repeating automatic rifles. Most of the courts have upheld that. Most of the courts have upheld that you can withhold the right to bear arms from people of mental illness or are felons. That you can restrict the kinds of weapons as long as you don't take away fully the right to bear arms. I think the important question that we should examine when we make these decisions is what effect do these regulations actually have on crime rates and the use of guns? And there is a huge debate in the economics literature about exactly this question. Is there any kind of relationship between the assault weapon ban and the drop in crime that we have seen in the last 20, 25 years or not? Are guns more widely available now than they used to be, and are they being used more often in crimes?
Examples like Australia, where they made people turn in their guns and there have been far fewer shootings, shed light on the situation in the United States?
Yeah, because that would be important to take into account when you decide whether something's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But the court and the Constitution don't say that the right to own guns is absolute, free of all regulation. Actually, no right is absolutely free of regulation. Even freedom of speech is mm-hmm. subject to reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions. So mm-hmm. someone shouldn't be allowed to interrupt you when you're giving a speech. And yet,
it happens sometimes three times in a session. Maybe four. It's a couple of them out there I don't trust still. Is it easy or difficult for nations to know the difference between wartime and peacetime in the 21st century?
That's a great question. It goes to this point we were going back to earlier. Let me say that one of the projects of the post-1945 world was the idea that there should be a clear dividing line between what's war and what was peace, and that you would make war very difficult to enter and to wage in the hopes that you just wouldn't have very much of it. The sad, unfortunate thing is that since World War II, actually the number of people dying in wars has gone up if you count civilians.
Mm.
If you count combatants, soldiers, actually casualties in war have really fallen. This fellow Steven Pinker wrote this book claiming that war is declining. He has a psychological reason why. Who knows whether he's right or not? But the empirical data is true. The casualties in war have dropped tremendously in the last 100 years. It's incredible, actually, several orders of magnitude. But the people dying in wars who are civilians has gone way up. I think the last figure I saw is 90% of all casualties in war are now civilian deaths.
This gets back to my point about visible versus invisible mm-hmm. deaths in war. The soldiers are highly visible. The greatest loss of life in our time was the Congo Wars.
Yeah, the Congo War.
And those were largely people, civilians, driven into the jungle and never seen again. They probably died of disease or malnutrition. No one knows. It's an extremely cruel, awful, and inadvertent loss of life in the millions.
But
no one could see them, so.
But also part of the book is that if we do try to have this clear dividing line between war and peace, and we make it difficult for nations to use force, they are going to be reluctant to use force in places like Congo, Syria, Rwanda.
And also people are going to be more visible. Civilians will be more visible in the future. Mm-hmm. And that may change the tenor of that kind of thing.
Maybe.
Call for more intervention.
Yeah. I mean, so if you want the United States to intervene more to try to stop these things, then you're going to see more of a blurred line between what's war and peace. There's going to be a lot more different stages of the status between the United States and these other countries in these situations. And I guess the argument about the new technology is that you want to make available lots more options to countries to try to put a stop to these things so that they don't get worse and so that you don't see genocides like this, particularly in places like Africa.
Mm-hmm. What is the biggest threat to U.S. national security today, and how should the U.S. respond?
So I would say the most imminent threat has got to be North Korea.
Yes.
I mean, you have a regime that seems to have tested a hydrogen weapon, and it has successfully shown it has the technology to reach the most of the continental United States with ICBMs. I mean, the other threats that might come from places like Iran or Syria are just farther down the road than North Korea. I worry that we are again putting ourselves in between, trying to figure out some kind of system of appeasement, or contemplating a military strike on North Korea, which would kill.
What's the third way?
Well, this is my point. It's like things in between.
Yeah,
using these kinds of weapons is unfortunately something like what we dealt with the Soviet Union. It's going to be persistent, unending, and it's going to be a series of trying to pressure them and stop them from pursuing this course.
This underlines the idea of the rise of great powers as surveillance states, because you cut off North Korea's economic lifeline by spotting every bit of foreign trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the administration has been doing that by identifying trade that other nations themselves didn't even know they were having with North Korea in the millions of dollars, not huge sums, so they miss them.
Mm-hmm.
But the U.S. spy services of one form or other are identifying these at a much more granular level. You can love or hate that idea, because in the abstract it means surveillance is going to be a very, very important part of being a great power.
Oh, yeah. Again, like we see the collection of vast amounts of data and its analysis domestically, it's also happening in war, but hopefully in this case in a positive direction, which is, again, to track down money flow. Even North Korea, which is one of the most isolated countries in the world, still depends on trade for a lot of the scientific equipment they're using. A lot of the advances they've made have been because of technology and information they brought from outside. Hopefully, again, it's about persuading the regime to stop its course, or it maybe not Kim Jong-un, but the people around him, the regime that supports him. That's something that used to happen in the 19th century all the time, and I think that's what we're going to have to return to.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the audience. Can you speak to the EMP threat to the U.S., electromagnetic pulses, knocking out huge amounts of the infrastructure?
Yeah, this is, you probably know, this is one of the most severe threats to American national security. It's something actually the North Koreans have just recently threatened against us. An EMP blast is...
God, they just don't stop.
they think everything. It's basically exploding a nuclear weapon high up in the atmosphere, which would not directly kill any people on the ground, but would send out a blast of radiation that would effectively short-circuit or fry most electronics and most electrical systems. So I think this would primarily be aimed at civilians, because I expect our government has actually hardened a lot of the systems that are important for national defense. But think about what would happen to all of us if all of the electricity on the West Coast was suddenly out of commission, and our access to, not just something, think of everything at transistors, and you wouldn't be able to start cars. The water systems would be shut down. Most things of modern life would shut down, and it would take months to replace it, or maybe longer than months. So that is a severe threat to our national security. The only way to stop it is with missile defense. I mean, there's no shield that we can build that would protect civilians from the EMP blast. Again,
We would regard that as an instrument of anarchic violence.
Oh yeah, that would be clearly an act of war, and it's really, again, it's designed to attack civilian life, not really to hit military targets, which are mostly going to be hardened.
Mm-hmm. Another question from the audience. I am not familiar with this, so I may mispronounce it. Since the Kellogg-Ryland Treaty in the 1920s, all treaties outlawing war and certain weapons have been futile, why even have them?
you mean the Kellogg-Briand Pact.
Excuse me.
Which,
thank you.
The Kellogg-Briand Pact. Some people, there's a new book out that finds it quite hopeful. It's also often used as an example of how utopian international politicians can sometimes be. But the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1924 banned war, if you didn't know it. And so... you know, had all, it did almost no good. But there, you know, it was, you know, it was made a mockery of in the 30s and 40s, of course. However, there are examples of nations cooperating to limit war. Nuclear weapons, biological weapons have not been used, and chemical weapons have not been used by the great powers against each other since World War I. Countries have used them against their own citizens, as we've seen in Syria. But countries have not used them against each other since World War I. Nuclear weapons have not been used since the end of World War II. So those are examples where countries have cooperated successfully. Again, sometimes people who believe in the Kellogg-Briand Pact and that movement think that international law can just ban a certain kind of weapon. But I think the important thing is to identify the conditions, to study those past cases, and learn from what the conditions were that existed that allowed those kinds of cooperation to occur, and then ask, what would we need to see today to be able to say there'll be cooperation, robotics or AI or space? Space weapons is a good example too. I should have mentioned that. There is something called the Outer Space Treaty, which does successfully ban the stationing of weapons of mass destruction in space. And no nation has violated that ban since the signing of the treaty in 1967, because no one lost or gained an advantage from it. The powers were mostly in balance on that. Notice they didn't ban weapons of mass destruction passing through space. So obviously ICBMs can carry nuclear weapons through space, and that's not a violation of the treaty. So you have to, I think if you want to have a hopeful story about things like the Kellogg-Briand Pact, I think you have to look for situations where there are rough parity of power between countries, and that you're going to see cooperation because no one really wins or loses out of the pact.
Mm-hmm. Would developing new weapons, are we in a new kind of arms race around these new types of weapons?
Yeah.
And would you care to handicap how the U.S. is doing?
So it's undeniable that we're in an arms race. I mean, if we didn't do anything in these weapons areas, China and Russia will. Again, China and Russia are pouring enormous amounts of their research and development money into these kinds of weapons and not into conventional weapons.
It's interesting. We see them, we posit both of them in competition with us. Are they competing with each other as well?
Yeah, they're competing with each other.
Are they hitting each other? And
They don't fully trust. I mean, remember, they fought a war against each other in the late
60s. They asked Henry Kissinger for permission about a nuclear attack.
Yeah, so they are not inherently peaceful towards each other. Nor is, I think, China inherently a peaceful country. If you look at the historical record, since the Communist Party has been in charge with China, they basically attacked almost every country next to it over time.
So we are in an arms race, not just with those two, but all these non-state actors and freelance hackers.
It's a cheap and easy way to try to equalize your military arsenal with the United States.
How are we doing? Or do we even know how we're doing?
So my impression after doing the research for this book is that we are quite significantly ahead, actually, in in cyber and robotics. Well, think about, I think a lot of this, I think we tend to exaggerate how good government just is at all this stuff. I think a lot of it piggybacks on the advancements in the private sector, as we've seen in other past military revolutions. Is there any great internet company in Europe? I mean, there is almost all the great innovation is occurring in the United States, and that is much to the benefit of our security as well as to commercial enterprise. So for now, as long as that stays true, we are taking advantage of that. But we were discussing earlier, China is certainly rising, and they are developing a lot of these technologies too in their commercial sector as well. And that means they are going to catch up on the military dimension as well. Russia, I don't think, is a serious long-term challenge, because I think their economy just can't support this kind of competition, despite the fact they have a lot of great mathematicians and computer scientists. I think this is an area where immigration reform could really help. We could invite them all to move to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And yet their involvement in the U.S. election is probably the most visible. Do we qualify that as a cyber attack at this point?
I think it's again goes to the point you were making earlier. that these new weapons and new technologies, they give us advantages, but they open up a lot of vulnerabilities too, not just by other countries, but other
organizations. If you want to discuss the manipulation of media power,
yeah,
that's a first-class example of that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there is no doubt, I think everyone agrees that Russia tried to interfere in our elections using cyber techniques. Whether they succeeded or not is the big question, but they certainly wanted to. And it doesn't even need to be that they wanted Donald Trump to win or not. They just wanted to.
I'm not sure whether they succeeded is the question. They tried to do it is the
they
question.
They tried, yeah. And they.
That's settled.
They wanted to undermine American faith in our democratic political process.
Which may be the big game here.
Yeah.
More than any winner or loser, cynicism about democracy and the outcome of an election would be of an enormous strategic benefit to the Russians.
And whether, you know, to call that war and to call what they did an attack.
Psyops.
So I would say we should dispense with those kind of labels. And we should just recognize the Russians are trying to coerce us and they're trying to pressure us in ways that may fall short of what we call war or not. We shouldn't handicap ourselves by saying, well, we're only going to respond to you if you reach a certain level. And then we're going to call it a war and then we're going to respond. Instead, I think we should be matching them. Now, that doesn't mean we should try to convince the Russians they didn't elect Putin, because that's not going to really work as a deterrent.
I think they're cynical about democracy already. We're not going to make a lot of ground
but
there.
But the thing that these, you know, cyber, I think in particular, gives you the ability to do is to inflict a cost on the Russian economy in some way that we think is comparable to what they've done to us.
Well, we already have done, if the press reports are to be believed, and you seem to credit them, that the Stuxnet virus... quite significantly harming Iran's nuclear program, appeared to perhaps cause a change in behavior around the way they were treating nuclear development as well, which may be the most successful cyber attack of all that the U.S. has done.
Yeah, so I mean, just one point about it is that I forgot to make it earlier, is that these kinds of weapons, when they're at that level of sophistication, like a Stuxnet virus, it is as if you had to build a whole weapons lab. It's not like some hacker can come along, get a college degree in computer science and pull things off the shelf and create a Stuxnet virus. Those kinds of cyber attacks really require the resources of a nation state, money, resources, and sophistication. And so when we do suffer these kinds of, you mentioned, yes, there's one feature of cyber attacks is that they're difficult to attribute, which is the fancy phrase computer scientists use. But we know when we suffer these kinds of attacks, if they break into certain kinds of systems, only one or a few countries are capable of carrying it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I say we should respond in kind. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we should use bombs or use kinetic weapons. We should use cyber weapons too. I think we have been restraining ourselves. Stuxnet's a good example. We used it against Iran. But I don't think, at least publicly, there's any claim that we've used something similar against Russia and China, even though they've really been eating our lunch in the cyber. I mean, we've been having a low intensity cyber war with Russia and China for several years now.
Mm-hmm. And this is another aspect that bears examination. Traditional state violence, the use of the military, is highly transparent. We announce we're sending a carrier into the Gulf. We fly jets. It's on the evening news. This is closer to, you know, what Winston Churchill called that long twilight war. Does it continue that way? Does this just sort of exist below the surface and the civilians don't hear or know very much about it? And is that healthy in a democracy?
I think you make two really good points. I think that if you turn more to cyber weapons and robotics, you're going to see more persistent conflict at a lower level, just as we've seen with the drone conflicts that we've been waging against Al-Qaeda or ISIS. You see far less of it. It's less destructive, but it's more persistent. It lasts longer. The conflict is not ending suddenly. As I said, we're not having a signing ceremony on the USS Missouri at the end of the war. It's almost like war is a regulatory. You're regulating a problem. You're not seeking absolute victory, like MacArthur would say we should. So if that's the case, the benefit is you have less death, less destruction, less mobilization of an economy. The downside is, as you said, you have to have the patience, and you have to worry about whether a democracy can carry out a conflict for that long. I don't think we directly address this in the book, but I'll remind you, when the Cold War started, there were all kinds of people who thought that the United States would have to become almost an authoritarian state in order to successfully compete with the Soviet Union for 50 or 100 years. And there was a very famous book by one of the leading political scientists of the day, and it was called Garrison State. And it was an argument that the United States would become a garrison country because that was the only way to successfully compete with this. It didn't turn out that way. Actually, if you think about the period since World War II, this was, I would say, that one of the greatest periods of flourishing of civil liberties in our country's history. At the same time that we were also waging, as you said, a long-run, non-transparent, low-intensity conflict with the Soviets all around the world. And so it seems like a trade-off that we assume that in order to fight these wars, we have to give up a lot of civil liberties at the same time. But actually, I think the record of the Cold War is quite the opposite, and it may be true with technology that I think we're living through an enormous expansion of free speech. I mean, remember in the old days, there were three channels.
You mean in the past half hour?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it is free. If they had to pay for it, they wouldn't be able to do it so much. But sorry.
Now, John.
No, so my main point is that there used to be these, if you wanted to express your view and write an opinion piece, there were only a few TV channels and a few newspapers that controlled all right where these things came out. And now because of Google and Facebook and Apple and Amazon, there are innumerous channels for people to express themselves and conduct. I think this is incredible. At the same time, we're having this worry, as you say, that the necessities of these wars are going to require us to increase the powers of the government.
Now, this is you're a professor of law at Berkeley, and this book does call for a good look at a lot of areas in Washington and in defense. So you must have researched a lot of things that surprised you doing this. Is that scary? Is that does it make you more positive or negative?
Actually, of the things I studied, the thing that surprised me the most was robotics. I think there are incredible strides being made in robotics, and we are seeing them in the civilian economy. I think you're going to see them faster in the civilian economy and domestic, but the technology is the same. So that's one thing really was surprising to me, how we're all obsessed with the self-driving car, but think about medicine. I think you're seeing huge changes in medicine from robotics and big data. So diagnoses of people's problems can be done by doctors all over the world now from any location. Very delicate surgeries are being automated. I talked to someone who works in this field, and she said, if you had a delicate eye surgery, would you rather be operated on by a human doctor who might not have gotten enough sleep and might have been fighting with his or her spouse and drove their car too fast to work that morning? Or would you rather have a robotic surgeon do the surgery?
I think that can be hacked.
Who's going to want to hack your eye surgery?
Except a lot of weird, malevolent people out there.
But the point is that you're going to see this rollout is going to happen a lot. I was really struck.
And if you have cloud security, this will not happen as readily. The security standards are going to change.
The thing is, probably in warfare, that the change you will see will be, so far drones in a way are misleading because we think of robots as just replacing human beings, but everything else will kind of look the same. So a drone kind of looks like a normal aircraft, and so we imagine there'll be drone tanks.
Well, drone augmented jets. Soldiers don't.
Yeah. No, but I think actually they'll be quite diverse. What you're going to see are things that look more like Amazon delivery drones are going to be the weapons of the future. You're going to have not a gigantic drone firing missiles. You're going to have things that look like very large birds or insects, and they're just going to swarm targets and crash into them. That's the future of robotics. It's all harnessed and linked to the changes that are going on in the civilian economy.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm pretty close to our last question. I wanted to ask you about writing this book, about the reception you've had, but in light of the fact that the discussion has been interrupted, I did want to ask, that's not the first time that's happened to you speaking publicly. What has your experience of all this been like?
All this,
both in doing this book and in the past 15 years since you were involved in writing the memos justifying the policies of the Bush administration.
So protesting doesn't bother me. I've been a professor at Berkeley for more than 20 years, and it wouldn't be spring if there weren't a little tear gas in the air and some rioting.
Well, that's just a light way to put it. But,
it's just like protesting is just like in every present feature of being a professor. Look, I'm from the East Coast. This was very shocking to me when I first showed up, how much of it goes on all the time, how much energy and resources people pour into it. But at the
weigh on you. Have you reflected on that part of your life and rethought your decision?
No, they don't, because this is the optimistic side of me is, I'm an immigrant from Korea. And if things had turned out a little differently, I would either be building nuclear missiles or growing rice in a paddy. So I think I'm really damn lucky to be here. Credit, I still can't believe that I got hired by Berkeley. I'm a conservative professor. They must have made a mistake. So I think I'm very fortunate to teach at Berkeley, one of the great universities in the world. And so if the price of it is, sometimes some people get overly excited and leap up and can't contain themselves, I'm happy to pay that price in order to participate in this, this great American experiment. I think I'm damn lucky to be here, so I don't mind a little protest now and then.
And are there things you would have done differently at the Justice Department in hindsight?
I don't think so. I would have.
It's a fair question.
No. I've thought about that.
I'm sure,
but I think. I was in this position in the government. We had just been attacked on 9/11, and I was asked questions I never thought I would be asked. And I those are the most difficult questions people in government have ever had to face, I think. Also, the other thing I thought was my duty. I was given that job, so that I had a duty to answer them as best I could. And so I tried to. So I think I reached the judgment that I thought made the best sense of the law at the time. The other thing one could do is resign.
Right.
I mean, if you really, if you disagreed with what the government has done, but I will notice a lot, I will note a lot of our critics, a lot of the critics of the Bush administration served in the Obama administration, and they didn't close Guantanamo, and they ramped up the use of drones, and I didn't see a lot of people resigning from office.
Fair answer. Okay. Well, thank you. Our thanks to John Yoo for joining us this evening.
Thanks.
We want to remind everyone that copies of John Yoo's new book are available for sale, and he'll be happy to sign them at the back of the room right after the program. We appreciate your letting him make his way to the signing table as quickly as possible. I'm Quentin Hardy, head of editorial at Google Cloud, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.